Hello, my name is Jay Remery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 749, being recorded on July 21st of the year 2013. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to present to the audience John Loftus, former Justice Department investigator and the author of numerous books. John, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thank you, Dave. You know, I have to say, I don't do a lot of radio interviews, but I always make time for you. You're one of the most informed guys around.
Well, even speaking like Elmer Fudd in the wake of my surgery, hopefully it will be temporary. But I tell you, I've dealt with some formidable opponents in my time. None of them more daunting than the medical bureaucracy. It is Kafkaesque. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I just filed a $70 million lawsuit. The predecessor to a lawsuit against the Veterans Administration, they're just terrible. It will shock people's conscience to see just how bad these folks are.
That's a whole other subject. John, of course, you are a native of Boston, Massachusetts, and a couple of stories pertaining directly to the hub or Beantown have been in the news. Let's go back to something we touched on at the end of side two, which is the Boston Marathon bombing and the Charnia brothers. What are you in the position to tell us about that incident and those people?
Again, the rule is I only can deal with public source material, but
sure.
I would point out, does everyone remember the uncle of the bombers who denounced them so vociferously on TV and said they were a shame to the family and so on?
Uncle Ruslan.
Yep. Now, he is the head of a Chechenian organization, and the address for that organization is his father-in-law's address. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is by, you know, apparently, a CIA front. The father-in-law is one of the most senior people in American intelligence.
A guy named Graham Fuller.
Mm-hmm. And that's his address. That's the P.O. box, the mailing address for Uncle Ruslan's Chechenian charity. So there's a lot more to the story than we ever know. The mother of the bombers immediately appeared on a Russian television show, and she said something very significant. She said that her sons couldn't possibly have been involved in the bombing because they had been under close FBI surveillance for at least 5 years. She said the FBI was trying to recruit her sons. I think she's you know, telling the truth, that the FBI, just the first time they heard about these boys wasn't a year previously when the Russians said, oh, keep an eye on them. They knew about these two boys 5 years before that. The FBI, knowing that these kids were, the older brother, were involved with the Islamic terrorist group, the FBI was trying to recruit them.
As informants, basically, double agents.
The same way the FBI tried to recruit Samuel Aryan, the guy in Florida that I eventually sued and exposed as a terrorist. You know, this is a major scandal that's bubbling at the edges. The FBI is saying, oh, well, we only heard this about this guy a year ago, but the Russians didn't give us actionable intelligence. The mother is saying the FBI was meeting with her and with her sons, and they knew all about, you know, which websites the sons were going to and which Islamist groups they were in contact with. So now perhaps the mother is lying through her teeth, but to what reason, I couldn't imagine. But I think she's telling the truth, that the FBI had a long-standing prior contact with these guys and is simply trying to conceal it now that it has literally blown up in their face.
Do you think it is possible? I realize I'm asking for an opinion, but the one of the permutations of this case appears to be basically the FBI recruiting people that, whom they knew to be jihadists who were actually working for perhaps the Muslim Brotherhood affiliated faction of U.S. intelligence.
Well, in the case of, for example, Samuel Alarion, the FBI had a recording of Alarion screaming into the telephone that Hamas was taking credit for a killing that Alarion's group, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, had paid for. And this was hurting Alarion's fundraising in America. After they heard that tape, that's when the FBI went to recruit Alarion as an informant. Now, so it doesn't matter if he kills people as long as it's Jews and he's killing them overseas. The FBI has done this for a long time. I found files. I'll give you the name of an FBI informant. His name was General František Kuchel. And General Kuchel was an SS auxiliary in charge of the slaughter of Jews in Belarus during World War II. He was an FBI informant because the FBI used him to spy on Alan Dulles and on the British Secret Service that employed General Kuchel. So this is a long-standing policy where the FBI allows the most vicious of criminals to remain untouched in return for information. And this leads me to another FBI cover-up, also from Boston.
Sure. By the way, Boston has been the focal point of a lot of coverage by the Flock of Birds in connection with the Whitey Bulger case, but the Flock of Birds did not manage to touch the information you presented in Valhalla's Wake. John, tell us about that.
Yeah, there was a young man named John McIntyre who was murdered by Whitey Bulger. Actually, there were witnesses who said that they saw Whitey strangle him. John McIntyre was a drug smuggler bringing marijuana into Boston, and barge loads of it, with the help of an Irish contact, an Irish-American who was an admiral of the Coast Guard. And the money was supposed to go to the IRA to support, you know, freedom for Northern Ireland. McIntyre became disillusioned and became a drug informant for DEA. And his identity was revealed to Whitey Bulger, and that's why he brought McIntyre in and killed him. And McIntyre's dad happened to be an old friend of mine. John McIntyre Sr. was one of the first of America's covert agents at the beginning of the Cold War. He worked with General Galen inside the Nazi intelligence compound that survived World War II.
John, veteran listeners are very familiar with Reinhard Galen's name. For newer listeners, and being on there for 34-plus years, there are newer listeners. Tell us who Reinhard Galen was.
Reinhard Galen was the German intelligence general responsible for, from the Heere Ost, all German intelligence on the Eastern Front against Russia. And he was supposed to be the brilliant young man who was going to lead the Third Reich to hit the victory if only Hitler had listened to him. Now, I've always thought, and most intelligence professionals think, that Reinhard Galen was a bit of a jerk, you know, a pompous idiot who just didn't produce much except publicity for himself. And I mean, if his intelligence operation was any good on the Eastern Front, Germany wouldn't have lost the war. He was just a pompous idiot who, you know, presented himself well. So McIntyre was one of the first Americans to work right inside the Galen compound. His job was to go behind the Iron Curtain and to make contact with Galen's former agents who are now living under Russian-occupied territory and to, you know, establish communication with them. Very dangerous job. The elder McIntyre was dying and asked me to, you know, find out what happened to his son. So I, you know, did a book, Valhalla's Wake. It turns out that the family was playing me, that they knew who had killed their son. They knew it was Whitey Bulger, but they were trying to distract attention so that the surviving son would be left untouched. But they did. The McIntyre family did divulge some astonishingly correct information. They told about how the inside of how the IRA drug running worked and who it was inside the IRA that had penetrated American intelligence. They said that young John McIntyre had been recruited to the provost, the provisional IRA, by a man named Dick Sullivan, who was an Army prosecutor who was from South Boston, where Whitey Bulger is from. And as it happened, I knew Dick Sullivan. Dick Sullivan and I worked together at the Justice Department, and he had, you know, sort of tried to recruit me to the provost, which I thought he was just drunk and kidding, but apparently he was very sincere about it.
John Sullivan, again, was an Army intelligence officer.
Dick Sullivan, who, no, he was an Army lawyer.
Dick Sullivan, an Army lawyer, and he was...
He covered up John McIntyre's narcotics conviction in the Army in order to get young John back a top-secret clearance to work on NSA-type wiretapping in Europe.
Okay.
Cleaned up his whole background. So there can't be too many Dick Sullivans who are former Army prosecutors who live in South Boston.
So now, how does, because again, we have younger people in the audience, and you and I have never spoken about this on the air, how does Dick Sullivan... play into the IRA penetration of U.S. Or the Provo IRA, and how does this obtain to the case of McIntyre Jr. and what happened to him?
Yes, well, it turns out that Dick Sullivan's goal was for IRA intelligence to penetrate the U.S. government. So he worked with me in justice and used... you know, I was doing this investigation of Nazi war criminals who were on the CIA payroll, but the CIA didn't know they were Nazis. Sullivan covered that up and coordinated I just found this out recently. In 1985, you know, I was testifying before Congress, and Sullivan had falsified the backgrounds of the people involved. I had named a guy named Mikola Lebed as the highest-ranking Nazi in America. Mikola had been the chief of the Ukrainian version of the Gestapo. His troops had murdered Simon Wiesenthal's mother and a few million Ukrainians and a few million Jews. Just a really despicable guy.
Now, his group was the OUNB, was it not?
Right, the OUN Bandera faction, the most right-wing faction of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists.
Listeners can go to the SpitfireList.com website and just Google that or use the search function. And there's tons of information about it. Okay, Mikola Lebed, John, go ahead.
So Mikola Lebed was the guy that Sullivan used to penetrate CIA. He covered up Lebed's background and told Congress that Lebed was the leader of the anti-Nazi resistance in the Ukraine.
Not a particularly accurate assessment under the circumstances.
No, not when he's the head of the Ukrainian Gestapo,
right.
The Služba Bezpečnosti. And Sullivan certainly knew that this was false because I had briefed Sullivan personally on all of the top secret files on Mikola Lebed. But see, Lebed had to be covered up because his visa was signed by the Attorney General of the United States.
And this is a
not department helped state to bring in Nazis. Lebed was one of them. So by covering up Lebed, you know, Sullivan was able to penetrate CIA.
So you've so got.
I was actually had a testifier under oath, a justice of sworn deposition, saying, "Hey, Dick Sullivan, it looks to me like he's the highest ranking IRA mole inside the CIA, and you guys have never touched him." And you know what? The Justice Department never told CIA about my testimony. And Sullivan may have been the man who tipped off Whitey Bulger that John McIntyre was a mole.
Wow. So you have an Army attorney working with Justice Department, and he is using a Nazi war criminal and SS/Gestapo veteran officer of the Ukraine to penetrate U.S. intelligence on behalf of the IRA.
Yep, and while he's there, he had access to find out who were the moles within the IRA, found John McIntyre, gave him to his fellow friend from South Boston, Whitey Bulger, and Whitey strangled him.
Just a bit of a backstory. Of course, Bulger and one of his now bitter former associates and bitter enemies are widely reported to have been FBI informants while they were carrying on decades worth of lethal criminal activity. The U.S. attorney in who was over them at that time is Robert Mueller, now head of the FBI.
Yeah. Now, here's the amazing thing. The FBI knew, for example, that some of the information Whitey Bulger gave them was false. But to protect Bulger as their informant, they let three innocent men go to prison for 20 years.
Wow.
Absolutely horrific.
It's also one of the reasons why, I mean, it may sound cynical to some listeners. There's a passage from Nietzsche that I really like where he said, "A joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling." And I find myself laughing sometimes out of feelings that have died, watching and people saying, isn't this outrageous about the, you know, the Snowden disclosures? We've known about it for decades. We've spoken about it for almost two decades on the air intermittently. So I find some of this ruffling of outrage, bird feathers, to be very difficult to take.
Well, the FBI is, the FBI is split down the middle. The younger group loves me because I'm helping them cut the ties to the Muslim Brotherhood and to CARE and all these crazy groups. But the older group just believes in J. Edgar Hoover's motto, lie, cover everything up. I mean, there was one point where we broke the Russian telegram codes from their embassy, and the Russian codes in New York revealed that there were two members of the FBI in New York City who were Russian spies. And there was a big debate within the FBI what to do about it. And, you know, the counterintelligence team said, well, let's just transfer these agents out one at a time until we see the telegram stop, then we know who the agent is. Hoover was afraid that word would get out, so he told them to do nothing. J. Edgar Hoover actually let two communist spies remain in the New York office of the FBI rather than face adverse publicity. So that's what the old guys did. Rather than admit that there was a connection with Whitey Bulger, that put innocent men in jail, that there were murders going on, they covered it up. You know, rather than, and no one told the CIA that McIntyre's recruiter was inside the CIA.
That is one of the most Byzantine, the Dick Sullivan, McCullough, Thebed IRA connection, is one of the most Byzantine manifestations that I have seen in decades of following intelligence imbroglios. That is one for, I guess one could say, the books, including yours.
I mentioned this in America's Nazi Secret. I mentioned Sullivan and listed the documents where, you know, Sullivan actually produced a Gestapo poster, a wanted poster for McCullough Lebed. Oh, my God. What a fraud.
Really, that's something else.
A friend of mine, Dr. Anthony Birds, has did recent interviews with surviving Ukrainians who were killed by Lebedev's forces and going over the captured Ukrainian Nazi files. And there's no doubt this guy was a monster. But in 1985, the House Judiciary Committee was defrauded by this guy, Dick Sullivan, who protected Lebed's reputation and thereby protected the old corrupt people within state FBI and justice. And by the way, it goes on. Remember there was a case of a Nazi caught recently in Minneapolis?
Sure, a 94-year-old guy.
Yeah, he worked for McCullough Lebed. They were both part of what's called SSSD. SD is Sicherheitsdienst. It's like the CIA of the SS.
SS intelligence, basically.
Yeah. So the guy in Minneapolis was lieutenant, but he had to be cleared by Lebed's security service, the Schlussbadbeschba, and above them was the original SS general in charge of the Ukraine, in charge of Four Commando Moscow, and we recruited him and put him on the payroll.
Yep. Was that Mr. Bandera?
No. Bandera was the political type. This was the German Friedrich Burckhardt.
Okay, yes.
He was the original leader of Einsatzgruppen B. Bandera, well, here's a good example. Bandera was the politician in charge of the OUN.
Right.
And the Germans said, oh, but he's too nationalist. They kept him under VIP house arrest for part of the war. After World War II, the CIA refused to touch Bandera with a 10-foot pole. Okay? And that's because Philby was peddling him, saying Bandera is wonderful. So they took in Bandera's number two, Mykola Lebed. And the CIA didn't know that Lebed was Bandera's assistant because of this phony background saying that Lebed was an anti-Nazi.
I know in the original Ballara Secret, you quoted Frank Wisner Sr. at length, you know, touting the virtues of the OUNB.
Yeah, that they had carried out 30,000 assassinations inside the Ukraine.
Yep. When Mr. Yushchenko became head of the Ukraine, he was married to the former Ekaterina Tymoshenko, who had been deputy liaison of the Reagan White House and was the head of the number one OUNB front group in the U.S., and later Yushchenko named not only Bandera, but also the fellow who led the liquidation of the Lvov ghetto as heroes of the Ukraine. John, we have about a little less than 10 minutes left in this side of the interview. Members of the listening audience are certainly familiar with the phenomenon of globalization, and it is generally thought to be a recent phenomenon. In your books, plural, you have written about a couple of things that I would like you to detail for us and reflect on those against the background of globalization. One is the Webb-Pomeroy Act, as World War I was drawing to a close, and the other is the World Commerce Corporation, which was formed in the immediate aftermath of World War II. And I wonder if you would reflect on those against the background of globalization and fascism.
Yep. I think that, well, globalization is the international corporations, I think, are the last unregulated pirates in the world. The law doesn't touch them. We don't deal with them very well. Back in 1918, when we had Teddy Roosevelt all passing all these laws against monopolies, trusts, and cartels, well, the robber barons of Wall Street were furious. So they passed a loophole law called the Webb-Pomeroy Act of 1918, saying that they're allowed to form monopolies, trusts, and cartels overseas, but not in America. So the overseas thing, that's why during the Great Depression in the 20s, all of the American investment capital was being sucked out and going to investments in Germany, where we backed the infant Nazi Party, we backed the Bolshevik Revolution, and we backed the House of Saud in their attempt to throw the Hashemites out of Mecca and Medina. So two out of the three of the revolutions paid off. And again, by we, I mean, this is 1% of the 1%. You know, these are the most corrupt people in America. And they literally financed the rise of Hitler. They financed the rise of the Bolshevik Party. And they financed the rise of Ibn Saud.
How about now something that you wrote about in the Unholy Trinity, your second book, co-authored with Mark Arons, and that is the World Commerce Corporation. If you would detail that for us and how that manifested in connection with the pan-global economy.
Sure. A lot of people, you know, have all these wonderful legends about the Odessa file and where the money went. Well, the money was simple. It was laundered out to the Vatican Bank and then, you know, other Catholic fronts down to Latin America. And from Latin America, an organization called the World Commerce Corporation invested Latin American money back in post-war Germany. And the World Commerce Corporation was on this board was Sir William Stevenson of the British Secret Service, and the lawyer was Alan Dulles. So the stolen Nazi money gets laundered through the Vatican, down to South America, then back through World Commerce Corporation, back to post-war Germany for the great economic miracle of West Germany. Basically, what it was that the stolen money was laundered, you know, in a full circle, and that, you know, the money that the American investors who had invested in Nazi Germany were able to keep their profits. The Thyssen Corporation, for example, it's now the largest conglomerate in Europe, the ThyssenKrupp Corporation. Both Thyssen and Krupp, by the way, were convicted Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg.
Sure.
You know, that's how high up they were. But in the classified paperwork, 30% of the Thyssen Corporation was owned by the Rockefellers through Chase Manhattan Bank.
Sure.
That's how, you know, the money got paid back. So there's this huge scandal of globalization where there's this one faction that had a lot of money but very few scruples in America, and they financed dictators. Didn't matter whether they were communist dictators or fascist dictators, as long as they were dictators, because they could, you know, provide the protection that the American businessmen wanted. So we had this tiny minority of wealthy people making America's foreign policy to protect dictators, and the rest of the country said, no, we believe in democracy. So the Arab Spring is classic. We have congressional funding, this wonderful charity run by former CIA people, to train young people all over the Arab world to have coordinated uprisings, nonviolent ones, in 2011.
And
at the same time, we have this old group, the Wisners, who are trying to protect investment by supporting dictators. This isn't just the things that you and I research. They may go back, you know, half a century or more, but they are so critical to understanding what's going on today.
In other words, business as unusual.
Yeah. You know, I guess there's an old saying, if you want to find out what happened yesterday, read the newspapers. If you want to find out what's going to happen tomorrow, read the business section.
Indeed. One of the things that I find so much of this to be, well, you know, people were talking, for example, in the last couple of years about the 1% versus the 99% and the forces that you have identified in connection with the Webb-Pomeranz Act as World War One was drawing to a close, and the World Commerce Corporation in the immediate aftermath of World War Two are basically that 1% or the 0.1% of the 1%.
Yeah. It's hard to understand this history because it's so intertwined with international economics, but, you know, it's how all of us in favor of democracy in all of these nations, our will has been frustrated by people that, sold our birthright for a mess of pottage, that they simply wanted a few corporations to be backed by dictators for easy and excess profits.
All right, John, we're almost out of time here. Tell listeners where they can find more information about your works, your books, forthcoming articles, etc.
Well, my last book, America's Nazi Secret, was by Trine Day, but I'm going to try something new with my next one. I'm going to do a series of books called Spy View. That's my column with Ami Magazine in New York and Israel. And my Spy View books I'm going to do through Ex Libris, one of those companies that sells both the trade paperback version and, more importantly, the electronic version, because I'm trying to be a self-publisher to see how that works. So look for a book called Spy View in a few months.
All righty, very good. And if listeners would like to recap our many visits with John Loftus over the years and long text excerpts of his various books, SpitfireList.com has all of my life's work available on it for download for free, plus a library of old anti-fascist books. And at the top of the front page, there is a link where you can order a flash drive with everything on that website and more available. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record, program number 749, interview with John Loftus, being recorded on July 21st of the year 2013. For John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying, thanks for listening.